Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming. We really do want to get started because our discussant is going to have to leave early. As it turns out, he has an appointment to fix a tooth, so we'll forgive him at 11:30. What we're going to do this morning is first we're going to have our speaker, Lawrence Brohm, give his remarks, and then Doug Paul will be our discussant. We'll go into the Q&A for a while, and then after Doug leaves, we do have a video that Lawrence Brohm would like to show. We were originally going to do that first, but now since Doug Paul has to leave early, we've decided to move that towards the end. So let me briefly introduce our speaker and our discussant. Since he arrived in China, I think, in 1981 as a student, Lawrence Brohm has authored 20 books, and he spent 25 years in Asia. Many of us visit Asia a lot. We analyze China, in particular U.S.-China relations, from afar. I am certainly of that latter category, and Lawrence Brohm has spent most of his career living in Asia. His impressive bio includes the restoration of heritage architecture. He has served as an advisor to the governments of China, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Mongolia on financial, banking, and enterprise reform in the 1990s. And he has served as an interlocutor between Beijing and the 14th Dalai Lama. Lawrence Brohm describes himself as a global activist, an international mediator, a political columnist, and I think also a documentary filmmaker. He is the leading advocate and, I think, creator of the Himalayan Consensus, which he will talk more about later on. He is also the founder of Shamhala, which he will probably tell you more about. It is a social enterprise committed to action for ethnic diversity and cultural sustainable new models of ecotourism development through heritage restoration. For those of you who perhaps have been lucky enough to have visited one of his inns that he has restored, there's the Red Capital. What's the
Red Capital Club?
Red Capital Club, right? This it says I have Red Capital Residence, but I remember that was not
That's
right.
The hotel.
It's the hotel. Okay, so it's the residence and the Red Capital Club, which is a terrific restaurant. The House of Shamhala in Lhasa and the Red Capital Ranch, which is next to the Great Wall. And Lawrence will be talking a little bit later about his most recent book, which is called The Anti-Globalization Breakfast Club, Manifesto for a Peaceful Resolution. His talk today is entitled Red Guards Carrying Credit Cards, U.S.-China Relations and the Future. And then following him, we will have Doug Paul, whom many of you know. He is currently Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Doug previously served as Vice Chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase. He was, prior to that, the U.S. representative to Taiwan as Director of the American Institute in Taiwan. And Doug and I have known each other more than 20 years.
Yes.
I won't say how many, but we go way back. And I'm very pleased that he's agreed to come today and be the discussant on our panel. So without further ado, we will begin with Lawrence Brohm.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. It's really an honor to be here at CSIS, and also a great honor to have Douglas Paul here as the discussant. Today I'm going to really talk in two areas. I'm going to talk primarily about China, Red Guards Carrying Credit Cards, and then after the discussion, I'm going to show a video which is related to my new book, which is actually not related to China at all. It's about more about South Asia and economic development. First of all, Bonnie mentioned I wrote a lot of books about China, and we have a saying in Beijing, when somebody comes to Beijing for a week, they go away writing a book. When they stay there for a year or two or three, maybe they write an article. And if they stay past that, they really don't know what to write at all. Well, I've written a lot of books, so it probably doesn't mean that I really have much that I should be saying. Scholarship on China coming out of CSIS and other institutes here is quite excellent. I wouldn't consider myself a scholar, and I wouldn't consider myself a China expert. I really hate that word because I feel there's nobody who is a China expert. The Chinese always call us foreigners, Zhongguo, Lao Zhongguo Tong, but actually none of us are really Tong. Living in China, the longer you live there, the more you understand that there's much more to understand, and that actually very few Chinese themselves understand the mechanisms and the transformation of the society that they're in today. So really what we can do is try and grab an angle, something to grab onto, to try and make a little bit of sense about the transformation that's taking place. And I thought that the 10th anniversary of, or the, I'm sorry, a 10-year perspective on the 60th anniversary, which was just held, the celebrations on October 1st, would be a good way to begin. 10 years ago, on October 1st, I was invited to be on the West Rostrum at Tiananmen Square and to watch the celebration and parade. And 10 years ago and today is very different. I'd like to reflect on that and see what kind of lessons we can draw from that observation. 10 years ago, it was a period of reform. Jiang Zemin had finally consolidated power after a lot of political juxtapositioning. Many didn't even expect him to be able to survive. And Zhu Rongji was then premier, heading probably the broadest set of social and economic reforms that any country has tried to, or attempted to take in history of the world. It's just enormous if you think about not only the restructuring of the state-owned enterprises, that's a lot more than privatization. It involved the whole restructuring of society. You know, an enterprise could be 20,000 people, have schools, healthcare, housing. All of those systems had to go under tumultuous reform. And I remember sitting there on the rostrum, and the journalist pit was over to my left. And there was just a feeling of tremendous enthusiasm because China was taking on this challenge of reform. And nobody was really sure whether it was going to succeed and where they were going to go with it. But there was a feeling of just, you know, excitement. And that excitement was underscored by the fact that we were entering sort of the dot-com boom, and many Chinese who had ironically left China, had fled the sort of post-89 crackdown, had gone to America, gone to Europe, they had MBAs and law degrees, and they were all coming back to participate in the reforms. And at that time, the mood was just extremely positive, and the feeling of everybody in the business community who was involved with China was these reforms are not only going to be structural reforms, they're going to involve a whole opening of the country. The view of business people in China was that engagement would change China. By having more multinational corporations, more young Chinese working in multinational corporations on internet every day, that the society was going to transform, things were going to become more open, and we somehow believed China was going to become more like us. Maybe in sort of diplomatic terms, easier to deal with. And in that context, you know, I remember the highlight of that moment, the highlight of that parade was Jiang Zemin rolling in this old Hongqi limousine under Mao's gaze through Tiananmen Gate and past the troops, and all of them shouting, you know, kind of the, serve the people. And there was this huge juxtaposition between China now moving toward capitalism, the sort of backdrop of imperial dynasties, and the sort of communist, you know, modern history. And in the minds of us foreigners, we were sitting there saying, how is China going to juxtapose all these things? They don't seem congruous. But I think in the minds of everybody who was Chinese, there was some sort of continuity to it all that was not being broken. Now, 10 years later, there's a different mood, a completely different transformation looking at the celebrations that occurred just less than a week ago. But before I talk about those celebrations, I want to try and put things into a context, because in working or dealing with China, whether it's in business or in diplomacy, we look at things often from our perspective, from American perspective or European perspective. But there's a veneer, a Chinese perspective that I think needs to be addressed to put it into context. The significance of October 1st, 1949, was Mao Zedong said the Chinese people have stood up. And regardless of what he did in the Cultural Revolution, the view today, looking back in the minds of most Chinese, is that Mao was a hero because he wiped out all that stuff that had gone on since the 19th century opium wars, foreign incursion, breaking up China, Japanese invasion, all of that stuff that was kind of a stigma from the late Qing dynasty when China was maybe arrogant and closed to the outside but backward technologically, had to be cleared up. It was kind of a, in Carl Jung terms, unconscious type of baggage. And since then, the transformation of China since Mao has been linked to Chinese people's own perception of themselves with the West, a kind of inferiority, superiority, psychosomatic conflict that had to be cleared up. And of course, after Mao, he declared, okay, Chinese people have stood up, you know, the PRC is established as a country, but there was the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward. China was embargoed. It was ostracized. It wasn't part of international conventions. So even though the revolution had been victorious, those things were not cleared up. Those burdens were still there. They're always lurking in the background. And there on October 1st, 1989, Jiang Zemin was beginning to clear this stuff up. And several events would actually be watersheds for that. One was Jiang Zemin's visit to the United States. It was a state visit, and it was very important at the time. I remember that. I think that was 98, that visit. And it was so crucial that he be received with a state banquet and 21-gun salute, because in their mind, it was a recognition. It was that after Tiananmen Square, 89, the kind of collapse of U.S.-China relations or the apparent breakdown of that he had now mended the relations, he had brought things back. And then the second watershed was entry into WTO. And in a way, suddenly China was being accepted by the International Club of Trading Nations as an equal. That was another highlight. And the third was the Olympics. And the Olympics was, I think, the most important. I remember the frenzy in Beijing streets when China was awarded the Olympics. It was something that no other country has had, and it's connected to this acceptance. We are being accepted into the international community. Now, coming on 10 years later, the situation is very, very different. 10 years ago, we sat there in Tiananmen Square wondering whether the reforms would be successful and whether China would become the factory of the world. Today, it's the bank of the world. This is like total transformation. And the messages that were being sent, okay, you had, of course, the Olympics a year ago. And this was so important. But the Olympics was being put into a context that's different than we put it in. I mean, sporting event, great. It's for the athletes. But for China, it was so much more. China said, don't politicize the Olympics, but it became very politicized. It was almost mandatory as a diplomatic procedure for the head of state to be attending from each country the opening ceremony. This was so important. But again, in the context of China's history, it was kind of like vassal states coming to China. China once again was in the center of the world. Certainly was in the center of the world's attention. And even the architecture, I mean, these things didn't go past me. The water cube for the swimming was the dragon's palace. And the bird's nest was connected to the return of the phoenix to its nest. These were all powerful imperial symbols of China's past that were now being put into a very modernistic context. And so I saw this as having very little to do with the Olympics that we think of. Plato's Republic, Sparta, Athens put down their arms and everybody has a good sporting event, competition. It was not about that. It was about the imperial power of the, or authority of the dragon emperor. It was very much, these were the symbols that were pouring through. And once again, this became apparent on the October 1st celebrations. There's a painting, you know, there's these wonderful propaganda paintings. They're very kitsch, and I collect them. Red Capital Club is full of them. And there's a new one that they've done, which I think says it all. It's Mao announcing the founding of the Republic, People's Republic, looking to the side, and Deng Xiaoping is looking to the side, and then Jiang is standing in the sort of the other side of the painting with Hong Kong behind him and Pudong. Okay, Hong Kong was transferred back to China under Jiang, and Pudong was, you know, the great experiment in economic reform that worked. And then the last is Hu Jintao, and his hands are out like this, and there's rockets shooting off behind him, and airplanes, and money, and it's like you know, you just won the house, you know, it's like the casino, you know, you hit the jackpot. And the message is very clear. The message was going from Mao onwards, you know, here I'm bringing you prosperity, I'm bringing you wealth. And, you know, we have achieved it. China's number one. I wrote a book in 1994 that got me in so much controversy called China's Number One. I was just trying to sell books because Ezra Vogel's Japan is Number One did so well. But you know, now it's China's Number One. That was the message they got. And within this context, you know, I began to think about, you know, what does it mean? And there were images at the parade. There were more missiles and technology than there were soldiers. That was a very important message. China is ready to fight, but it's also ready to do it on terms with the West. I mean, it's high tech. They're no longer, you know, the sort of mass line army, many people being thrown at, like in Korea. This is the message. A lot of radar equipment was being shown there. That means all under heaven in the celestial kingdom is under surveillance. Another message. The Hu Jintao at the end danced with people in the square itself. I don't think any leader has gone down to the square to be with the students since Mao received the Red Guards. This was, I understand, Jiang Yimou's idea. You know, choreography. On one hand, he's holding a Tibetan girl's hand dancing, the other a Uyghur. Also, messages are very clear. And with this, you know, we had a kind of a whole expression of China being wealthy, China being rich, micromanagement of every single move in that parade was absolutely phenomenal. And I also got another message that micromanagement will bring you prosperity. So don't go looking for, you know, too much in the idea of you know, maybe Western freedoms or democracy. Micromanagement will bring you prosperity, so stick with it. It seemed to be the message that was being sent. And I thought about this. And I thought about where we were 10 years ago. And at that time, you know, we thought with the, you know, certainly with the Olympics, wow, you know, China now has to deal with foreigners with the Olympics. Journalists are going to come here. How are they going to manage the journalists? Protesters, how are they going to manage the protesters? This is going to be great because it will break China out of its shell. It'll make it more Western, more integrated, more open, more responsive. But that hasn't happened. Actually, the opposite has happened. Before the Olympics, our ambassador, Sandy Rant, and at the time our ambassador, was invited to look at Beijing public security systems, and every street corner is under surveillance. And, you know, he was, you know, this was presented as a great thing. Look, I mean, we can stop terrorism in its tracks way before anything gets going. I mean, you know, this is like, you know, Dick Cheney's wildest dreams come true. And China did it. Dick Cheney didn't do it. So, you know, again, China is number one. This was, you know, the message. And, you know, we expected more openness. We expected more freedoms. I must apologize if anybody in this room today wants to be my friend afterwards. You won't be able to get on Facebook, and I won't be able to receive it in China because it doesn't work. So these were the changes that we saw, and these were, I think, the things that were happening now. Now, put in another context. Media is all... How are we doing for time?
That's up to you.
Okay. 10 minutes. We have, you know, again, I mentioned the propaganda poster and how that affected me. And there were also rising images of nationalism and pride. And I'll just throw these out as kind of a spectrum of impressions. When our Stephen Chu, our energy secretary, and Gary Locke, commerce secretary, came to Beijing, Business Daily, I believe is the paper, came out with a cartoon of them as bananas. And questions of Chinese journalists were, how do you feel being Chinese? And their response was, I don't, I'm American. But that nationality card was being buzzed around. Moving on, I was watching a documentary for the 60th anniversary, and it was covering, you know, the history of China and covered, of course, the Cultural Revolution. And the messages of the Cultural Revolution were very clear. Democracy brings you this chaos. Deng Xiaoping called for stability. With stability, we have prosperity. I mean, the formula is very, very clear. And then before I came to Washington, I was, you know, in Hong Kong. I flew up on a CA flight back to Beijing, and I was looking through the in-flight magazine. Now, in-flight magazines usually have tourist destinations and lifestyle and hotels. But there was a whole section in the in-flight magazine about poor Americans living off the street in Santa Monica, Los Angeles. Is it Santa Monica Beach? Yeah, Los Angeles. And you know, how, you know, they're so impoverished, and, you know, it was really like, and then you turn the page, and it's all about estates, wine estates, and rich Chinese going to wine estates, and one thing after another about luxury travel. And the message was very clear. You know, the economy, the center of the world is in China now. And I guess the pièce de résistance was the China Daily did something about cultures and had the Qin Dynasty, Han Dynasty, was making a comparison with the Roman Empire. And there was, of course, this very big picture of a Qin warrior that was larger than the Roman warrior. And the title on it was, because there's an exhibit of Roman art in Beijing, the title was Empire Strikes Back. And they're not very subtle about these things, you know. And the messages that come through are connected, I think, very much with what is now the mantra today. The party's mantra is concept of scientific development. Now, those of you who are an internet company shouldn't get too excited, because it doesn't mean that they want to promote internet. It means that Marxism is scientific. Jiang Zemin said that. And so it puts it in a context of, you know, GDP growth will bring prosperity. And with this, this is scientific. This is more or less the thinking or the context within which this is being presented. Now, that said, this moves on to the future of U.S.-China relations. And I had written a piece that PACnet CSIS had published earlier this year, in which I called it the 3 points of cooperation. And I reflected back on what Jiang Zemin had said. We should not always be talking about conflicts, differences in values and differences in systems. We should find our commonalities and work with the commonalities first. And that's a good chess game. You know, take the things, the easy stuff off the table first and make some progress rather than being stuck on the hard issues. So I wrote a paper I called The 3 Points of Cooperation. I visioned U.S.-China relations developing along these three lines. The first is finance and investment. And while we talk a lot in our context about bonds and China, you know, continuing to buy, you know, state treasuries, I think we should talk about investment. I think we should be bringing Chinese investment into America in the same way they promoted American investment into China. And we should use the same tools, like promotion of trade organizations. We should set up offices for the promotion of trade in Beijing, in Shanghai, and real estate, and let Chinese people come here and invest in land. I remember this was a controversy in Thailand in the early 90s, and it was Chachai, then prime minister, later deposed, who said, well, what are you afraid of? To buy our land? They can't, foreigners can't take it away. Eventually, foreigners are going to die. The land is still here. It still belongs to us. I think we should be promoting investment into America from China. Secondly, security. This is an issue for both countries of concern. It ranges from Taiwan to Korea to arms trade, drugs trade, terrorism, and, of course, the Himalayan region. And I think the Himalayan region, which I consider from Afghanistan all the way down to Myanmar, to be high combustion area right now, a lot of potential problems. And this is really where China and the U.S. should be focusing cooperation. I don't see war over Taiwan or Korea, but I do see a lot of problems in this region, and both countries have a lot of opportunity to work together. That can also include environment security, which is the third area of cooperation I highly encourage. And this is also one of the areas where we may have a lot of difficulties. I live in Tibet much of the year. The glaciers are retreating at such a fast rate, it is incredible. It used to be I'd fly in October, and from October through May, you would see the whole plateau covered with snow if you flew low. Last year, it wasn't covered until January. The Brahmaputra River is a mere creek in some parts of Tibet. Sand dunes are on both sides. This is very dangerous stuff. This has got to be the biggest security issue, because the Yangtze Yellow River, the Mekong, Irrawaddy, Salween, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, Indus, all have their source of water from the glaciers. And it's a very delicate biodiversity cycle. If that cycle is broken, two-thirds of humanity doesn't have water to drink. We can give our children money, we have prosperity, but can we give them water to drink? This is going to be a major problem for China. South Asia will bring them into a clash. Environmental issues have got to be the priority, and it's a place we can make progress. But it's also an area we're going to have problems, because I envision, we were looking for a big standing ovation in Copenhagen. We may not have it. Even if agreement can be reached in principle, there's a lot of problems. The environmental organizations in China, the Bureau is not very powerful. And because of the reliance on high GDP growth, it is burning up a lot of resources, and China is not able to make that transfer to the green technology. We need to make the transfer, but this has got to be the priority area of communication between both sides. On that, I have a couple of suggestions that I'll make as closing remarks. One is the strategic and economic dialogue. I think it was brilliant that Hank Paulson created the strategic economic dialogue, because being investment banker background, having spent a lot of time in China, he realized this was a way to get progress, and more dialogue is better than less. Also, his counterparts at Wang Qishan, who I worked with when I did work with Premier Zhu Rongji's cabinet on enterprise reform, and he's somebody who can get things done. And getting things done is difficult in China, because the bureaucracy doesn't always sing the same song and listen to the same vibes. Combining the strategic and economic dialogue looks good, makes for great PR, wonderful meetings, but I don't think it's effective. I think smaller approaches are better. We should split it up. And I think we should have permanent offices of the strategic and the economic dialogue in both countries for daily rapport and discussion on these issues, daily coordination. Part of the challenge of the reforms back 10 years ago and why Zhu Rongji was able to make it work was he created coordinating bodies, because there's so many different ministries and things that don't work and function together. And I think we should have permanent offices in both places. Lastly, back to the security issue and the Himalayas. I think there should first be, and this can be a win if Obama can do it on his coming trip, a bilateral commission on the Himalayan region for security, environmental security, and indigenous people who are essential to the maintenance of the biodiversity of this region. And if possible, expand it to a trilateral commission to include India, because they must be a player, and we are the three largest CO2-emitting nations. If we can get progress on this issue, then we can make progress on a lot of much more smaller issues. So thank you for listening to me today. and we can open up.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. Lots of interesting ideas for us all to talk about. And first, we will turn to Douglas Paul for his thoughts and observations.
Well, thank you, Bonnie, and thank you, Lawrence. It was easy for me to agree to do this event because I've been familiar with Lawrence's work and I have admired what he's done for ordinary Tibetans. If you zoom down to Tibet, and we've all been watching the uprisings and other events of the last 2 years, if you zoom down to the events, the Chinese generally will tell you, along the same lines as Lawrence has described China generally, they've been pouring money into Tibet, doing great things for Tibet. The Tibetan people are not adequately grateful for the progress that's been made, and when they have these uprisings, they should be suppressed. Lawrence has intervened in Tibet directly. Those Tibetans who are not getting the opportunities that are coming to Tibet but are being distributed largely to Han Chinese who come from elsewhere outside Tibet, he's been able to provide employment and cultural integrity, and this is something I've really admired. Unfortunately, the government of China still has some distance to go to make this come up with the same perceptions of the changing needs of the Tibetan people under the conditions which have been changing around them. The talk of the Red Capital Clubhouse reminded me when I was a graduate student at Harvard. We have a charming institution at Harvard called the Hasty Pudding Club, which puts on very tasteful entertainments every year. And 1 year I competed to submit a sketch for presentation. It was called The Red Landlord. I had envisioned communist landlords in their marching cadre of young female Red Guards high-kicking for the audience, but it lost out in the competition to a play forever to be known as Rhinestones in the Rough. Pardon that little discussion. I'm taken more and more, and Lawrence's presentation this morning brings this point to me very clearly again, at how China is at one of those really important points in its long intellectual history. Those of us who studied Chinese intellectual history, or pretended to study it back when, were always looking into the works of Joseph Levinson, who studied Liang Qichao, a modernizing man who was well-educated in Chinese tradition and trying to wrestle with the challenges to China of maintaining the integrity of Chinese culture and scholarship and values, and at the same time not being supine before the inroads of technology and force from the outside world, from the West. The dichotomy between Ti and Yong, the essence and the application. The search that Ben Schwartz wrote about, the search for wealth and power that Yan Fu was the spokesperson for in Chinese traditional culture, really came home in this parade this last week. I wrote a piece on this in the South China Morning Post if you want to get on the internet and see a little more on the subject. I think that many, many Chinese now feel that they have resolved this contradiction that took place over the last couple hundred years. In fact, I've often said for the last couple hundred years it's been a very unlucky thing to be Chinese. History has been very tough on the people of China, certainly the ordinary people of China. But in the last 30 years, a great deal has been accomplished to lift the quality of lives and to give people a source of pride in China. And it would be shocking to, I think, any cultural anthropologist or social anthropologist to say that the people who witnessed the change of the last 30 years wouldn't feel the tremendous burst of pride and accordingly would also be very sensitive to reflections from people that are on the subjects that are not so well advanced in China. When outsiders talk about Xinjiang and Tibet and the problems there, when we point out the pervasive corruption in the official ranks of China, when we look at those people who are left behind, the petitioners in the streets of Beijing and other cities, people whose land is being taken by corrupt officials, they don't want to hear it from us. They might want to hear it from themselves, and we see indigenous movements towards greater outspokenness in China, even when they're up against a tough regime that wants to micromanage, as Lawrence has pointed out. But they certainly don't want to hear it from foreigners. They would like us to sort of admire and stand in awe rather than to come in and meddle in their affairs. You'll find exceptions. It's 1.3 billion people, but I think that's a fair generalization. I think Lawrence has spoken to another phenomenon a bit indirectly, which is how China has shifted its emphasis from the liberating forces of the 90s to a greater concentration on rigging the game for state-owned enterprises in China. And Professor Huang Yasheng has done a recent book on this subject, which I'd refer you to talk about how there's been a reversal from the rise of private enterprises or smaller township and village enterprises, which were the dynamic force in the 1990s, to an emphasis on building global competitive national champions. And this, of course, presents its own dilemmas. China will have to figure out how you create national champions in a hothouse environment and then send it out into the world fully competitive. It's like trying to, you know, have an NFL championship football team, but you only scrimmage against each other until the Super Bowl. And you go out and you may or may not win. You don't know how well you're going to do. And China is reverting to that. Before I get to the final two recommendations that Lawrence made, just one more observation from the benefit of looking back through time. We ourselves in the United States, and I'm sure it's been true elsewhere, have been through these periods of tremendous pride-taking and arrogance. It should be part of our understanding of what the Chinese are going through. With respect to the Olympics, Tokyo's Olympics and Seoul's Olympics were true coming-out parties. Now, I see they're an old enough audience, you might know what a coming-out party is here in most cases. But a true coming-out party for Tokyo and Seoul and their Olympics gave them tremendous national pride. It was an impetus to infrastructure improvement, to making life better in all sorts of ways in Japan and Korea. And in the case of Korea, it was the year that actually practical democracy returned to Korea, so it was celebrated in many dimensions. And so China today is sort of not so unique when it has its Olympics and brings the symbolisms to bear that Lawrence discussed of the phoenix returning and the dragon head rising. The United States, too, in its period of rapid rise in the 1880s and 1890s, when there were mansions used 1 month a year all up and down K Street, where we are right now, used to be all gilded era mansions of people who had the benefit, unlike ourselves, of not having to pay the IRS anything every year. And so they could have large houses in all sorts of places and come here for the social season midwinter and have a few dances. In that period, we were pretty arrogant and jingoistic. We did a lot of things to our neighbors, including Cuba and the Philippines, that caused a lot of clucking of tongues back then, much as what we're expressing today about our concerns about China's rising capacity and reemergence as a naval power after 400 years. There's a lot to draw from that. On the question that Lawrence has raised of these permanent offices of the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, I have to say, I imagine Ambassador Huntsman would be very upset to find out another office would be showing up in Beijing, because he probably thinks he is doing the job of the Strategic and Economic Dialogue's regular maintenance of activity. The more intriguing issue to me is this Bilateral Commission on Himalayan Affairs, and we talked about it briefly yesterday. I still haven't got my head wrapped around that idea, because I find it very difficult to understand institutionally how we as Americans would bring something to that could be so narrowly focused as on the Himalayas. But I'm really taken with the pointedness of this concern we need, despite our institutional, what I think might be our institutional shortcomings, we ought to search for a way to be more helpful in our own interest development, social, political, and environmental developments taking place in the Himalayas. It's a marvelous part of the world, and I think Lawrence has done an excellent job portraying the the knock-on effects of all those river valleys feeding all of those billions of people around the world. And it sounds like a very good objective to be added to the long and difficult agenda that's going to probably be bobbled at the upcoming Copenhagen meeting, because we're still a long way from getting to even Copenhagen goals on a multilateral basis. With those thoughts, I look forward to opening up the conversation.
Oh, thank you very much, Doug. I think it's important for both of our countries to look for new ways to cooperate with the Obama administration, attaching such great importance to climate change. Your proposal about working on environmental security in the Himalayas might be very appealing to people in this administration, and certainly could have some real consequences, I think, for the people who live in the region. I think I'd like to start with a question about the U.S.-China relationship, perhaps ask both of you, and then we'll open it up to comments and questions from the floor. It is often said, I think, that despite the mechanisms of dialogue that we have created in this bilateral relationship and the number of times that our presidents meet, speak on the phone, and our cabinet secretaries engage, the many hours that we spend in these discussions, that nonetheless, that the level of strategic mistrust in the relationship is still rather high. And I characterize it in a sort of somewhat stark fashion. The Chinese seem to be convinced that the United States will not accept the emergence of a peer competitor, that it will seek to slow China's rise, and it will continue to seek to encircle or even contain China in the future. I think our track record actually belies this, but this seems to be, I think, a widely shared view and suspicion. And some people say that really hampers the willingness of China to cooperate with the United States on a whole range of issues. From our perspective here in the United States, I prefer the term uncertainty rather than suspicion. I think we are just really uncertain about what China is going to do with all this great power that it is amassing, not just the economic power, but the military power that was displayed on the streets of Beijing, the soft power that China is just beginning to actually develop, and its certainly advancements in science and technology and other areas. China is determined to build comprehensive national power. It's in this period of 20-year period of strategic opportunity that it has identified, but what it will do when it achieves whatever goals it has set, I think, are sort of at least in doubt. So what is the best way to really start chipping away at this strategic mistrust? Will it be enough to cooperate in functional areas and on issues that relate to, for example, climate change, which many people in Washington, there have been some studies that have been put out that have suggested that this is a way to really promote strategic trust between the two countries? Or will we really have to look to more hard security issues? In the history of our relationship, certainly it has been issues like our cooperation against the Soviet Union that have brought greater trust to the relationship. I would say in the George W. Bush administration, issues like opposition to concern about Taiwan independence and cooperation to stem the development of nuclear weapons in North Korea were probably the issues that brought our two countries closer. But I'd like to hear your comments on that issue, and then we'll open up the floor.
I think the mistrust factor bothers me a lot, because there is a sense of mistrust. There's also a building feeling in China today that a lot of its problems are caused by outside influence, outside pressure, outside attempts to contain its rise. We need to get over this. If we don't get over this mistrust factor, then it will hinder cooperation. It will hinder it not only
between phone calls among presidents, but it will hinder day-to-day cooperation at the, you know, people-to-people level, at the business-to-business level. The environment may be a way forward on this, and I come back to the Himalaya initiative concept, the glacial retreat. We have technology, green technology. China wants that. We have areas where we can cooperate on this. If we can find something where we can cooperate together and achieve progress, it will be a step in the direction of lowering mistrust. There is very much the feeling in China that America wants to contain it, that it, you know, that we fear its rise. This is, I think, a predominant general view. We have to change this view. Otherwise, we cannot move forward. And certainly, I think the common enemy, if you used cooperation or collaboration against the Soviet Union as an example, the common enemy now is global warming. Because this is not a question of comfort of lifestyles. It's not a question of convenience. It's a question of human survival. And the two biggest CO2 emitters are China and us. So we have to work together on it.
I wasn't expecting to end suddenly, but on the CO2 issue, I'd be interested, Lawrence, on your observations of whether or not the Chinese can really participate in an international regime on this. Given the swelling pride of the Chinese people and the prickliness about outside interference and the sense of possession that people have about this tremendous new industrial capacity, are they really going to be able, psychologically and politically, to be able to join in an international regime that will impose constraints on their industry?
Well, I must say I was one of the first people to congratulate when Zhu Rongji signed the Kyoto Protocol. And they took a step ahead of us on that in climate change. That said, they have a position on per capita emissions and a position that, you know, the industrial West, you have, you know, industrialized, now we have to catch up. But at that rate of per capita emissions, it's deadly. So we have to get over this issue. This is a starting point. Once we can get over this issue, China has the potential to actually leapfrog the West on green technology. It has that potential. It has wind and solar sources of energy, which, if harnessed, can be tremendous. I reflect back. This is kind of going left to go right, as this Chinese saying goes. You know, go west to go east. I negotiated Ericsson's first deal in China. Reflecting back, China was so backward in terms of telecommunications in those days. Back in, it was 1991 or 92. I mean, it was so backward in terms of the telecommunications. Now it has leapfrogged. I'm sorry to say, but the mobile phone that I use here is really backward. I was making calls to my Beijing phone yesterday because of, you know, connection problems here with a local phone. And I use this as an example because they had a blank slate. They had it could be written on. It was like a kid. You could do whatever you wanted with, you know, developing that child's direction. And with the environment, they have that opportunity right now. It's a window of opportunity, but it will require technology. It will require tremendous cooperation between both sides. The danger or the downside of this is because of the decentralization process that made the market economy work in China, the local level government can do what they want and they don't listen to the top. It's a big problem, particularly on issues like the environment. A lot of the protests you have right now in China are not about democracy and not about ideological issues. They're about people being, you know, poisoned because of the environment, because of, you know, contamination. And local authorities not doing anything about it. And local authorities are under pressure. GDP growth, the only way you're going to get, you know, raised up in your rank is if you have, you know, high growth. And so you have a series of, to use Chinese word, contradictions that need to be sorted out. Because even if you have policy at the state level, implementing at the local level is a problem today. You know, there's a Chinese saying, the sky is high and the emperor is far away. And I think that's really very applicable. And the local level, you know, may not implement. So how to do this? I think it not only needs state-to-state cooperation, it also needs business-to-business cooperation. That can work at the local level if local officials can be incentivized through profitability or through other standards to be able to support green technology. We have a tremendous area to work together where both countries can lead.
All right, let's open it up to the floor for questions. And please wait until the microphone arrives. And please also identify yourself. Over here.
Thank you. I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council. I wonder if Doug and Lawrence would like to address the issue of the extent to which all this nationalism and pride and power of the new China helps the party's image. There's been a suggestion it's helped the images of Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin. What about the party itself?
Thanks, Tom, for the question. I think that it's almost a commonplace now among the China-watching community, however expert it may or may not be, to say that the Communist Party survives on a structure of two pillars, a pillar of a growing economy and a pillar of nationalism. If they had a pillar of ideology that was holding it up, that's long gone away. And today, the regime, I think, demonstrates every day through its behavior that it has to stir these patriotic sentiments, take advantage of them, and demonstrate that it is doing the things for the nation's pride that justifies the form of rule and governance they practice. And at the same time, they have to fill people's bellies, give them jobs, and improve their material well-being. And this has been a consistent theme of the past 30 years, and I think it's become even more sort of visible as time has passed, because the other things that they use to justify continued lack of diversity in the structure of governance are falling away over time.
I agree completely that the two pillars are high economic growth, keeping people very satisfied, at least a large part of the upper middle class, and nationalism. Keeps the party in, you know, that's basically the mandate of heaven. Where that gets tricky is if the economy goes. And this is what concerns me, because on one hand, we are dependent on China buying our state treasuries, and China is, you know, spending money on its own stimulus package, but biding time for our consumption to come back. At least they think it will, to boost exports again, because their you know, massive foreign exchange reserves were built up over 15 years from direct inbound foreign investment and exports, 60% of which are from foreign invested enterprises. Many economists in China are betting on our recession ending this quarter or next. I don't know if that's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen. Their economists are predicting we may go into another recession. Of course, you know, they're all crystal balling. If the global economy improves, that's good. The nationalism card will not need to be played as heavily. If the global economy tanks again, China has again is affected, then the nationalist card will be played. And that's not good. That would then unravel the very trust-mistrust issues that we were just talking about, which I think are so crucial. This is what I fear.
Thank you, Yuan. I'm with the Voice of America. Mr. Brahm, you mentioned the cooperation in the financial sector and also investment as one of the key areas that the two countries can start to enhance their working with each other. But if we look at China's track record in the last maybe 4 or 5 years in ODI, it hasn't really had a lot of success in investing in developed world. It may have had a lot of success in Latin America, Africa, or Middle East, Central Asia. So how would you suggest the Chinese government or the Chinese enterprises can go about just end up with more success in investment in the United States? Thank you.
Well, the investments in Latin America and Africa are primarily resource-driven. They're driven by the need to secure resources. And so this is kind of a non-brainer for Chinese enterprises. And, you know, they've been able to move forward on it. But I think that, you know, we need to encourage them into America. We have had a lot of blocks, a lot of restrictions. There's a lot of, you know, nervousness about Chinese investment here. I don't think we should have that nervousness. I think we should open up. The other thing is they're not comfortable in an environment which is different. You know, doing business in China has its, you know, there's a certain way of doing business. And when you step out of China and you're in the United States, it's a lot different than Africa and Latin America. And they're not comfortable with that. We need to actually reach out and encourage it and put the kind of mechanisms in place that they put in place for us. They had all kinds of organizations like CCPIT that would go and try and promote investment, you know, connect people up with different provinces. You know, I think the different states should try and do this as well. I mean, there's real estate sector. Why not bring in Chinese investment, really? It's just a question of reaching out and providing the means and mechanisms to do this. I think we have been, to a great extent, the fault of not encouraging it and not trying to find their way of doing business to bring them in.
Thank you. I'm Joanne Thornton. I'm with Concept Capital, Washington Research Group. And question for both of you with respect to China as number one economically, industrially, etc. Where is China with respect to being the responsible stakeholder in the global economy with global economic institutions, as Bob Zoellick laid it out a couple of years ago, talked about the environment a little bit, but what's the mindset in China with respect to this whole concept of the need for economic rebalancing that is now being discussed? Thank you.
I don't think China's driven by ideology. I don't think China's been driven by, you know, wanting to assert its place in the world. I think they're driven by very pragmatic issues which have pushed China onto the world stage probably faster than either they expected or they wanted, for that matter. Those factors are, of course, the need to have high growth rates. The financial crisis has further driven that need. In turn, they are, to keep the machinery going, they have to have resources. So they have gone and they've invested in, you know, Latin America and Africa. They had this huge conference on Africa a few years ago, and suddenly the African countries were very happy. Wow, you know, grants and loans and things that came with conditionalities and years of negotiating with World Bank, IMF, and European governments suddenly were wiped out in an instant. China came in and built stadiums and roads. But of course, that was a quid pro quo, because they wanted to be able to secure the resources. In some cases now, that is gaining resentment because they have in many ways brought in their own markets, brought in their own labor, and in Africa this has, you know, actually turned people off in many cases. I think the world was looking to China a few years ago to stand up and be a voice. I think China has tried not to be an independent voice. It has been drawn into the G20 as a result of the breakdown of the Cancun WTO ministerial in 2005, which is when we started to use the term G20. And it was drawn together with the BRIC countries and other 12 countries is primarily because of grain subsidy issues. The same with the BRIC. We have had a lot of attention to this Brazil, Russia, India, China alliance. In China's view, I think it's less driven by the kind of Bandung rhetoric that you hear coming out of BRIC, you know, this sort of, you know, non-aligned state kind of language being resuscitated. It's more driven by very specific needs. And so I don't think you see a China that's entering the world in a way that it wants to take on responsibility or is thinking about how to lead. It's being more driven by the circumstances around it. It's being driven more than taking the initiative. And I think that the underlying modus operandi for all things is very, very pragmatic. There's no ideological bent here. This is not like Mao's era where, you know, he was thinking about, you know, global revolution or, you know, non-aligned states. None of this is really what's driving. It's very pragmatic, in some cases very short-term. But again, I think it's pragmatism that's driving China. And if we want to work with China in forming global policy with some idealism behind it, we have to find the incentives that are pragmatic, because that's what they're going to buy into.
I'm really supposed to be the chair, but if you want me to comment, I'll be happy to make a comment briefly. The term, of course, responsible stakeholder, when it was introduced by Bob Zelick in 2005, was really primarily meant in security terms. We were seeing China primarily as a free rider on a broad range of issues. I think the focus on China as more of a responsible stakeholder in economic terms, at least from my perspective, seems to have come more from the global financial crisis. And in this administration in particular, well, the strategic and economic dialogue first, but then the SAEND, I think, has really put more of a spotlight on the economic part of this framework of responsible stakeholder. I think that the Chinese, in principle, at least my sense is from what I have heard from the dialogue that they have had with U.S. officials, accept in principle the notion that their economic growth going forward needs to be more consumption-driven. I think the differences are, you know, how do you get there, and at what pace, at what price, and what is the U.S. going to do at the same time? We, of course, have said, yes, we need to save more, and we seem to be moving in that direction. We need to sustain it. So there's a lot of things that I think, you know, both countries need to do. And in that conversation, I think that the Chinese accept in principle that they cannot rely exclusively on or to the extent that they have in the past on export-driven development. I would agree with Lawrence that, you know, China is very reactive to what is going on around it. They continue to be very reluctant to be a leader on anything. Although I would say there are areas where the Chinese are putting their toe in the water where they would like to have more of an influence and perhaps shaping the future of international financial institutions will be one of them. This is one area in which I think we're seeing Chinese interest. But generally speaking, the Chinese think that the attempt by the U.S. and other countries to compel China to be a leader is actually in seeking to divert them from their primary task of domestic economic development. They really do not want to exploit every opportunity out there to try and make a difference. They want to be very selective in choosing the things where they are going to play a more proactive role. They want to ensure that it enhances their image, that they really can make a difference, that they won't become the target of criticism. You look at an issue like North Korea, and you could see it cuts both ways. When the six-party talks are going well, everybody credits China. And when they're not going well, everybody blames China for not using its leverage over North Korea. So getting involved has great risks, and I think this leadership continues to tell the foreign ministry officials and the people who have any impact on China's foreign affairs, which includes these days state-owned enterprises as well as the provinces, that they have to be very careful and think about the impact of whatever they do on their domestic priorities, because those really have to come first. So I think it's a work in progress. Anyone else over here? And then maybe we'll turn to the
Thank you. Michael Ashby, School of International Service at American University. You talk about the need basically to deepen relationship, the bilateral relationship with the U.S. and China on a number of levels, public, private sector, political, social elites, but also really, that necessitates a greater level of interaction among really just average citizens. So my question is there obviously are some very profound philosophical differences which exist between the Western world and China. There's no need to go over those. What role do you think those philosophical differences will play in an effort to broaden and deepen relationships, and how might that affect the next 10, 15 years?
Those philosophical differences are always there, and they're always going to be there. And I think that not talking is far worse than talking. I still encourage business. I still encourage trade. I still encourage all of these different ways of interacting. I come back to the strategic and economic dialogue. Again, there was a big kind of fiesta here in Washington when their delegation came. Good PR, great for the newspapers. Not good for working. I've negotiated many deals in China. My career was an investment negotiator primarily as a lawyer. And I must say that nothing was ever achieved at a big table. Everything was achieved through relationships, through a lot of time spent in the karaoke or simply being with people and working all kinds of back channels. We need a lot of those back channels right now. And that's why, again, I encourage that there be dialogue on strategy and on economics that is regular, that's daily, that are actually offices working together. I think we need to move in this direction quite quickly because grandstanding is, again, it's good for cameras, but in my opinion, it's quite useless. I think we need to be pushing these areas. Of course, student exchanges, when I went to China to study in 1981, I think I was the second group of American students to go there. We had relations in 79, 80, there was one group, 81, the second. There was very few people studying Chinese. And now, I mean, the numbers vary, but there's just a huge foreign presence in Beijing and in every city. And I think this is a really good thing. This is the people-to-people communication. And our universities that have done these programs have done more to forward relations on that level, people-to-people level. And of course, these students will go into business and they'll go into diplomacy. And this is, already leapfrogging where we were when I went to China. So we need a lot more of that.
Well, we're now going to show the video. It's about 10 minutes, and it will give you, I think, some really good granular insights into Lawrence Brohm's work in Tibet and elsewhere in the Himalayan region, which is and great film footage. Is there anything you'd like to say to set this up?
Say very briefly, I worked as an investment advisor to multinational corporations for over two decades in China, and I also worked as an advisor to the government on particularly SOE reform and some financial reform. And in 2001, I really suddenly felt that all the reforms and things that China, 2002, had achieved were on the right track, but I was really questing where China's soul would be, where its spirituality would be. So in 2002, I abruptly shut down my consulting business, did a completely crazy thing. Most people think I was having a midlife crisis. And I organized a film crew, and we went and started making documentaries. But what hit me were not the documentaries. They were, filmmaking in China is not a good business to be in, I'll tell you. But what struck me were the people I met, some who you'll see here, a monk who was running a cheese factory and supporting nomads, a very famous dancer who was a bi-nationality who was running a whole studio and an ongoing program for her people, for ethnic minorities, and how these economic platforms were protecting culture in many ways through protection of indigenous people, sustaining the biodiversity patterns of the region, And we're an economic model in itself, or a paradigm. I don't like to talk about models. I think we should get away from models and look at solutions. And so this film is a story of the quest that eventually brought me to move to Lhasa and to set up a whole program of heritage restoration, ecotourism, microfinance, and medical care, which is really where I spend most of my time now. So I'll share that with you. Thank you.
Himalayan consensus. Our current era of confusion calls for clarity. We need a new economic paradigm built on the solid foundations of ancient Himalayan wisdom. We need to join hands in a peaceful revolution of compassion, common sense, and protection of our natural environment. In 2002, ending my career as an investment lawyer, I crossed the bridge, traveling throughout Tibet in search of Himalayan consensus. I was struck by the wisdom of this land, respecting nature, which in turn nurtures man. I also realized the importance of ethnic identity, compassion, almsgiving, welcoming a stranger, caring for others. Our future survival as a species depends on both our continued diversity and protection of this planet. I sought a way to integrate UN Millennium Goals of reduction of poverty through programs of sustainable development that can preserve cultural and ethnic diversity. Traveling across Tibet, I realized our economic assumptions have all been wrong. People are not motivated by greed alone. Care and compassion count. Spirituality can be stronger than materialism. I learned from the grassroots efforts of several people. They inspire me.
这是牦牛的第一个厂，是吗？牦牛奶酪加工的就是第一个厂，就是这个牦牛的。这个工厂是我的想法，我这个厂子办的目的呢，一个是为这个本地的牧区增加一点收入，再加上就是我把这个奶酪加工了以后往外移卖的话，我把这个奶酪的有些那个利润呢，可以用到我们学校。学校是主要是给哪个哪些孩子？主要是牧民的，
这个很美，这是你们自己捡起来？
这个就是我们的垫脚石，是吗？
Planning to break ground on yet another school for nomad girls. I asked him why the school was so far away from any town. By having the school here in the mountains, Jigami Jensen explained, their traditional lifestyle will not be affected. I do not want to build a school in a place which might be inconvenient for the nomads. This is the second school I had visited. An Sang brought me to the first one in Lhasa.
做人的根本是一个善，就你必须有一个善心。都是刚才我在你的工作室看你设计的。对对对对。但是这个工厂做的。这里做。都是残疾人做的。对对对，是这样。还有因为自己办了这个厂吧，你像很多残疾人，很多没有自己没有家的地方，都到这里来。残疾人多少在这儿工作？
对呀，工作残疾人可能二十八个左右吧，工厂里面。工厂里面二十八个，134个学生。
这是残疾的，他也是有残疾的。两个残疾人，一个孤儿，他做的那个服装，做的一些工艺品卖了以后呢，完了养这些孤儿。
我觉得不管你是哲学也好，还是什么美学也好，还是什么别的其他，跟生贴近生活，贴近自然，贴近人性本身，生命本身是最有说服力的，而不是一个空谈的哲理。那么舞蹈本身也是这样，如果我们脱离了这个，我们就轻了，我们没有分量，我们没有一个厚重，没有一个底蕴，我们没有了自己。
Yan Li Ping had been traveling tirelessly for months to Yunnan's most remote villages, searching for traditional unspoiled song and dance. Rapid development would soon change these villages. Oral traditions would soon be forgotten. She brought these village children back to her studio with their songs and dance, the essence of village life. She was saving their culture.
穿个牛仔裤，不是吃麦当劳，也不是说是你就用一个电声乐你就现代。
We have to find ways of protecting that biodiversity, leaving it as natural and as wild as possible. There is an effort to help two of the villages at the base to earn from tourism and protect the area. Now they have a commitment to protect the area because it's their own land, as it is. And it's also a sacred mountain. It's their sacred mountain and their sacred lake where they go to pray.But there's a fear of a big developer coming in and taking in 50 square kilometers to set up an entertainment park. And that is exactly what should not happen here.
I saw these grassroots approaches as foundations of a new movement, calling for consensus communities built on solid economic foundations to sustain and develop culture.We need both material and spiritual elements together. We need compassion and pragmatism. I decided to return to Tibet and establish such an integrated community. We began by building a school. Give the Children a Chance is a progressive education program and model for rural communities that has led to the establishment of a kindergarten.Providing free education and the first Montessori program in a Tibetan region with training support from Montessori Beijing.
In the Montessori school in Lhasa.
The school supports 100 children who receive free education. Using wooden tires, we designed an adventure playground for the kids.
Bye.
Architecture represents a community's dialogue with the environment around it. We have given support to some 50 Tibetan artisans who are helping us restore one building after another, reviving ancient workmanship and craft. These buildings in turn have life as boutique hotels, restaurants, and shops.House of Shambhala in Lhasa is the flagship of our artisan programs and community outreach. Soon we had a consensus community. Adding medical and education, our consensus community programs quickly expanded across the Tibetan regions of Western China, with microfinance supporting artisan efforts of women and handicapped. Rug weaving is an ancient art passed from generation to generation.Today, most rugs in Tibet are made in factories in other parts of China. We have worked to retain the true tradition of empowering women's commune of rug weavers. With the Himalayan tiger near extinction, Tibetans began weaving rugs rather than using skins. We can learn from this. By weaving tiger rugs, we send a resource replacement message of environmental protection. Most jewelry in Tibet is imported. We are reviving Tibetan jewelry making.Giving women resources to unleash their creativity, in turn supporting themselves, giving them back their identity. The Malabid Breakfast Club initiative helps nuns supplement begging income by making prayer beads. The idea came from a nomad woman who needed our help to support her family. Monasteries are vestiges of Tibetan culture. We support monastery restorations. People come to monasteries to pray for sick family members. We establish clinics in the monasteries. Empower the monks as medics gives them Tibetan traditional clinics with Western medical support. We have reopened the books of Tibetan medicine knowledge and returned them to the monasteries. The monastery can reach out to villages and nomads better than anyone else. Let the People See is a program that we support to help doctors reach out to people and conduct cataract operations. For only $50, a blind person can see, but we need to bring the doctors to the people. Funding is badly needed. This is where we need the support. We organize regular events so that people can help us help people. Here we have hundreds of people from rural areas who cannot afford surgery coming. Children have a tremendous problem with cataract because of congenital and also poor nutrition. So it's very easy for them to have low vitamins and the cataract forms very early. So each contribution tonight of 800 renminbi covers two operations. 200 renminbi pays for the intraocular lens and 200 for the medicine for post-treatment and getting the doctors to the people. And here are the people. We need Himalayan consensus as a new economic paradigm that works. The three pillars of Himalayan consensus are pragmatic solutions, compassionate economics, and responsible governance. We have established Himalayan consensus communities for education, heritage preservation, artisan communes supported through microfinance, empowering monks as medics, and letting the people see. Since 2006, I have met with leaders across the Himalayan region, forging the principles of Himalayan consensus. They have joined the consensus, calling for an alternative approach to the global crisis which we are now in. They have joined the peaceful revolution. The manifesto for a peaceful revolution can be found in the Anti-Globalization Breakfast Club. Join the club.
Okay, well, in the 5 minutes that we have left, first I'd like to see if there are any comments or questions that remain from the floor, and then we'll turn back to Lawrence Brahm for his thoughts. Over here.
Hi, my name is Scott Mackey. I'm with Internews Network, but I just had a question related to the Himalayas, but going back to your comments about glacial issues, future water issues throughout Southeast Asia. And the question then is, what do you see the role of civil society, whether it be within China or be within countries in Southeast Asia, and the role of internet or the international community, whether it be NGOs or otherwise, in laying the groundwork for us to be able to, like, whether it's establishing a bilateral commission or otherwise, to make progress on these issues?
And before you respond, let me just see if there are any other questions or comments that we would like to collect before we turn back to you. Anyone else? Okay.
You need to work at all levels, and this is to a great extent what this book, The Anti-Globalization Breakfast Club, is all about. I mean, the book is not saying, you know, destroy the IMF and World Bank, as some of the protesters say. The titles intended to catch your attention. But what I'm talking about is multi-tiered approaches. You do need the IMF and World Bank. You do need to have government-to-government cooperation. You do need the NGOs. You do need the work at the grassroots level. One is not exclusive of the other. In one conversation I had with Jeffrey Sachs in Beijing, you know, on one hand, you need the top-down infrastructure investment. On the other hand, that dislocates often societies and creates the very problems that it's seeking to resolve. You need the grassroots as well. Often, working at the local level, at the grassroots level, more can be accomplished. We'll look at it in two perspectives: microfinance, working with communities. On the other level, you have the problem we talked about earlier. If you may have an agreement state to state on issues of environment, but implementing at the local level is a problem. And that's where NGOs can be involved. That's where business can be involved. Profitably, you know, making money out of protecting the environment. I found when I recently did a tour of Southeast Asia. I did two tours of Southeast Asia talking about this book. And to my surprise, it wasn't the NGOs and the sort of radical groups that were coming to my talks. It was business community. It was all corporations. And the question on everybody's mind was, how do we, you know, what do we do? We are facing environmental problems. We're facing a social response to both the economic crisis and a value crisis or value revolution. I said, you know, the role of business is either follow and you react to it, and you yourself become extinct, or you lead. And I found many young CEOs in Southeast Asia were finding ways to have, you know, water treatment plants in their companies or waste treatment, or actually developing alongside their traditional businesses, socially oriented businesses, community support businesses, environmental protection businesses, and finding ways to make that profitable. You know, and one of the things I said on my tour, which I think upset my publishers, I want everybody to ban books by John Wiley. They're my publisher, because they refuse to use recycled paper. I said my book has to be on recycled paper, and they refused. So aside from the Anti-Globalization Breakfast Club, other books of John Wiley's, please ban, boycott until they use recycled paper, because I believe that everybody in this room would spend 10% more on the price of a book, or even 15% more, if you knew that it was using recycled paper.
This is an ad for the Kindle. So you don't have to buy books. You can download them into your Kindle.
That's right. But the point is, you know, it's not aid. It can be profitable. What we're doing in Tibet is not, it may reflect the work of an NGO, but it's not an NGO because it's not aid. These are all businesses that are self-sustaining, that are creating local management, who are running the businesses themselves, running the operations themselves, running the clinics themselves. Our clinic is profitable. Our clinic, we've created so far, since we started this program, 4 consensus communities. We have opened already 3 medical clinics, and we'll have a 4th clinic open by the end of this year. And clinic's profitable. It offers Tibetan medicine services at 33% lower than the hospital does at the village level, and makes 33% profit on the raw materials that they're using. I gave them an incense production line to supplement village medical care, and offered to buy back all the incense for our hotel. I can't buy it because 5,000 people in the village all come to the monastery for the incense. It's a business. And so with this, we have a model, and the model is not limited to the Himalayas. I've had University of Hawaii and the state of Hawaii talking to me about bringing this approach to deal with indigenous groups in Hawaii through ecotourism, through organic farming, through different types of, I mean, indigenous population in Hawaii, many of these people are living, sleeping on the beaches. They have no income. And recently we had an intern with us last summer who's going back to Detroit and wants to see how we can create a consensus community in Detroit, looking at restoration of old buildings. A lot of, you know, history there, a lot of business that can be created in the community. I think what's very important is not just preservation, but re-empowering people with their identity. Because if people have their identity, they have self-esteem. And a lot of the problems that we are facing, also with security, is when people are marginalized economically and socially. They feel they are not part of the movement of our, you know, global world. Well, with globalization, we become a small village, so we need to bring some village values back into our economics.
Well, this has been a really, really terrific discussion. We've moved from China to the environmental security to more global problems. I'm really grateful that you came to us today, and I hope that next time when you come to visit from Beijing or Lhasa that you will let us know, and we can invite you again to do a future talk. Please join me in thanking Lawrence Braun. Thank you.